Hi, this is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast.
Yeah, buddy, when you roll the coal, tell me how can you roll when the wheels won't go?
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by the Salty Dogs? Y'all like Salty Dogs? Little Rock's premier feel-good country band, the Salty Dogs, have shared the stage with Kinky Friedman and Hank Williams Jr., among many others, and their music has been featured on TLC's Trading Spaces and HBO's Rectify. They have CDs for sale after the show, and more can be found at thesaltydogs.net. All right, well, welcome to a very special edition of Tales from the South, our Southern Athletes series, where some of the South's finest athletes bring their own true stories to life. We are on location at the Oyster Bar in the Stiff Station neighborhood of Little Rock, Arkansas. From the South is presented by William F. Lehman Public Library, and tonight's show is sponsored by Unity Martial Arts, just right here across the street in Stiff Station. And I'm your host, Paula Martin Morrell. On my right here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Before coming out of retirement to play for us, Mark was a house guitarist at the late Junior Kimbrough's legendary juke joint in Tullahoma, Mississippi. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? Each week we feature an artist, so tonight's featured artist is Little Rock painter Mara Weir, and our featured piece is this piece right here in the middle entitled Tomatoes, which is for sale. Our listeners can find out more about this piece and Mara at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern-style storytelling? Born in the 60s in Hue, the ancient capital of Vietnam, Master Bao No is the eldest of four children of educators. His mother was a language and literature teacher, and father was the president of the University of Da Nang. In addition, his father was the founder and grandmaster of the martial arts style Kung Nu, which means hard and soft. Master Bao has been training in martial arts since he was a young child. He is currently a 10th degree black belt and the second highest ranking member of the Kung Nu Martial Arts Organization. He is an accomplished competitor, winning various open competitions in both martial, sparring, and arts forms in both empty hand and weapons categories. However, his real passion is teaching and training others to achieve their goals. This summer, one of his senior students placed second in staff fighting and fourth in double stick fighting in the heavyweight division at the World Eskrima Kali Arnis Federation WEKAF Championship in Hungary. Master Bao also founded a simple and effective self-defense program called the Bao Way, which combines self-defense and interactive fitness into a highly effective and fun way for people to learn. Not limited to just teaching self-defense and martial arts, Master Bao is also a popular high-level volleyball coach. He enjoys helping kids reach their potential while having fun. Many of the players he coached are playing in colleges and universities. Master Bao lives in Nashville, Tennessee, and continues to teach and conduct seminars and workshops in both martial arts and self-defense in the U.S. and overseas. Tonight, Master Bao takes us back to the 1970s and a family story of survival in Escape from Vietnam. Ladies and gentlemen, Master Bao No.
That night in June of 1977, the rain came down hard, typical for that type of year in communist Vietnam. My mother gathered two younger brothers and me and told us the time had come. We knew exactly what she meant. The past 6 months had been carefully building up to this, and it was now time to execute the escape. In the rain and in the dark, we boys quietly left our house. My mother leaving on her own, we met her a couple blocks away and flagged a pedicab. We rode silently as the rain pelted hard in waves for about an hour until we arrived at a house outside of Saigon, now called Ho Chi Minh City. My mother introduced us to a boy about my age, told us to listen to what he said and just to follow him. We were to board a bus before daylight to a coastal city called Phan Thiệt. From there, we would catch a smaller bus to a fishing village of Mui Ne before dark. We then were to blend in, keep a low profile until complete darkness, and then follow the boy to the beach and meet the rest of the party, which included her, my youngest sister, our dad, and 14 other people. We would then sneak on a boat and slip undetected into the South China Sea and to freedom. I was 13 years old. Just a few years before, after we had received his doctorate from the University of Florida and then returned to his family in his homeland, my father was the president of the University of Da Nang and a well-known martial arts grandmaster in Vietnam. After South Vietnam lost the war in 1975, my family lost everything. Under the cover of darkness, we had hidden the back of a transport truck and made our way to Saigon, where we knew more people and would be safer. My parents had managed to lease a small one-bedroom apartment built on stilts above a parking garage in a crowded neighborhood of the city. Life was hard. Food and supplies were scarce and rationed. Every neighborhood was tightly monitored. Because of my father's background, his being educated in the U.S., we were even more closely watched. I don't remember exactly for how long, but it seemed like he would spend weeks at a time in some sort of labor camp as he was being re-educated or indoctrinated with communist propaganda. He would come home exhausted, covered with mud from head to toe. Numerous strangers had shown up at the apartment pretending to be our friends. There were many discussions in hushed tones. My siblings and I would hide as our parents listened to the BBC News or Voice of America on shortwave radio. My parents told us to be quiet because the man who slept on the cot below our unit was probably an informant. We all could have been arrested and sent away at any moment. After a previous escape had fallen through, we knew that this was our final chance. So under the cover of darkness, we slip out of Saigon and huddle in the boy's house listening to our mother. The curtains were pulled tight as our mother kissed each one of us goodbye, opened the door, and ducked back out into the rain. In the early morning, we followed my mother's instructions and made our way to Mui Ne with our young guide. We stayed out of sight along the way and hid in the cemetery on the outskirts of the village when we arrived until dark. The boy then led us to the beach. It was pitch black, except for the light from the lanterns in the village and the bobbing lights of the small fishing boats anchored in the distance. As we approached the beach, the sound from the surf got louder and louder, and we saw silhouettes of people against the backdrop of the lanterns on the fishing boats. We gathered with them as a group and made our way through the water toward one of the fishing boats about 100 feet away. In the darkness and in the water, we found my parents and sister. My brothers and sister were put on this odd round woven basket. However, since I was the big brother, I was told to just hang on the outside of this basket and float along until we got to the boat. We had to be silent. An agent had been assigned to each fishing crew to prevent fishermen helping others escape or escaping themselves. My father was to silently board the boat from the back and incapacitate the sleeping agent while the rest of us waited. But as he made his way from the stern to the bow, some of our group started to lose patience and loudly boarded the boat. Suddenly, I heard a scream followed by a loud splash. The agent then jumped into the water. "Help! Help! They're stealing the boat!" Panic ensued. My father yelled for the gun. He admitted later that he did this so that the agent would stop screaming. It worked. Events moved quickly from that point. A couple of men stayed in the back helping pull the women and children up on the boat amidst the panic and confusion. No one had noticed that I was still hanging onto the basket, waiting to be lifted up onto the boat. Before I knew it, I began to float away. Quietly and calmly, I kicked to maneuver closer to the boat. It was now pitch black. Fumbling my way for something to hold on to, I finally found an anchor rope and started to climb. The rope became limp and I slipped back into the water. For some reason, I was sinking despite trying desperately to resurface. Just when I started to feel hopelessness, this hand of God appeared out of nowhere, grabbing a hold of my wrist firmly and pulled me into the boat. My mother had saved my life. After what seemed like forever, the engine finally roared to life and we lurched into the darkness, bringing on our hope and fear with it. I fell asleep as the boat puttered into the night. When morning broke, reality set in. We were on the South China Sea in a leaky old wooden 30-foot fishing vessel designed for coastal fishing. During the chaotic moment, we had lost over half of our gasoline and only had enough to reach the sea lanes. After that, we would be drifting. We had no radio, only enough food for a couple of days. And worse yet, we had lost the water containers in the night. The only water supply left was in the bottom third of our rusty barrel. Luckily, the sea was calm on this first morning on the open ocean. The boat had a wooden pole in the middle of the bow as the main sail. A couple of men painted SOS, no food, no fuel, with black engine oil on both sides of the sail. We were all thinking that this was not going to be such a bad experience, nothing like the stories we had heard about the other refugees. Soon enough, a merchant ship would spot us, come and pick us up, and take us to America. By mid-morning, a small dark object appeared on the horizon, heading directly toward us. It kept getting bigger and bigger. It was a ship, just like what we had heard on the radio back home. They saw us, and they were going to save us. We were jumping up and down for joy. The ship's name was also familiar to us, Toyota. It was now so close that we could see the faces of the sailors and their fishing poles. But the ship did not slow down. It kept sailing right by the bow of our boat, its wake rocking and pushing our boat away. We were shocked and in total disbelief. It was not supposed to be this way. Unfortunately, that was only the first one of many we saw throughout the day. As darkness fell, we were faced with the realization that we may not be saved after all. One unexpected part about being on the little boat without light in the vast ocean on a cloudy night is how dark it is. I could not see my own hand even when it was only a few inches from my face. Not being able to sleep, I decided to keep my dad company while he was on steering duties and fumble my way from the bow toward the back. I snuggled up to him. The only thing that I could see was the glow of the small compass hanging on his neck. As we were making small talk, it seemed like the horizon became even unimaginably darker. Instinctively, my dad quickly steered the boat sharply to the left, just in time to avoid the huge tanker careening right where we were. The first half of the day, too, was pretty much the same as day one. We would waste precious fuel chasing every cargo ship on the horizon, hoping that they would stop and pick us up to no avail. Depression set in for many in our party. Some people started to cry. When the weather took turn for the worse, the wind picked up, the sky turned dark gray, and the sea boiled with anger. Fish with wings skimmed the waves as if trying to escape the angry sea. Our boat was now creaking and groaning with every wave. The men were desperately bailing water. The captain was straining to keep the boat from capsizing from the cresting waves. The boat climbing up each wave to then to come crashing down its trough on the backside and then straining again to climb back up another was like a boxer past his time fighting against a much younger and faster opponent. You could hear his body scream and moan while absorbing every blow. Our afternoon went on and on like that until total darkness set in. Thankfully, darkness chased all that nasty weather away. On the third day, the sea was much calmer. However, we were now very low on fuel, hungry, and thirsty. The sun beat down on us. I finally stumbled to the back with an old tin cup and took a scoop of water from the bottom of the rusty barrel. The water inside of my cup was red with rust particles. My thirst overcame my fear, and I sipped the water using my teeth as a strainer. Like the 2 days before, we saw many ships in the distance, but none seemed to see us or had chosen to ignore us. That night, we heard eerie sounds coming from all directions from the sea that sounded like people crying. Many Vietnamese are superstitious. People on the boat believe that the cry came from the souls of those who died in the previous attempts. Hope flowed away on that dark sea. On the fourth day, a large school of sharks followed our boat. Then out of nowhere, we noticed a red ball floating in the water. Then we saw another and another. It was rather strange, but welcoming. The balls represent a human connection that we were so desperate for on the lonely, vast ocean. That afternoon, a large white Chinese fishing boat with this bobble motion approached us. They gave us food and water and agreed to tow us to safety. For the first time in 3 days, we felt a sense of hope, almost elation. Then darkness came again, the tow rope went slack, and the Chinese boat turned off all the lights as it pulled away and eventually disappeared. I can't describe the feeling of being abandoned by other humans. I had seen war and its ugliness, but this was different. In war, there were enemies, and enemies were supposed to kill one another. We were not these people's enemies. We were desperate people trying to live. Yet, people chose to let us die. This is still very hard to comprehend. The fifth day, we woke up to a beautiful sunrise, but no one cared. Everyone was just quiet and deep in his or her own thought. The feeling of deep desperation was on everyone's face. Most knew we weren't supposed to give up, but many felt we just couldn't hold on anymore. Then someone yelled, "Hey, there's another ship!" I casually looked up and watched it pass on by like all the other ships. After it passed us, it suddenly seemed to grow larger and larger until I realized that it was backing up toward us. I felt whatever tiny spark of hope I had left catch fire and rage through my veins. We were going to be saved. Everyone on the boat was jumping up and down, cheering and screaming. My dad climbed on the ship and somehow changed their mind from just giving us food and water to letting us board the ship and saving us. The ship's crew dropped their cargo net down to our boat for us to climb up to the ship. It was a very dangerous 30-plus foot climb as waves slammed the boat against the side. I was under my sister to make sure that she didn't fall. My mother and brothers were on the side next to me as we were climbing up. With all of us finally safe on the ship, I took my first gulp of clean water in 5 days and watched the crew lift our boat from the sea with a crane and place it right on the deck. And that's when I realized how small and fragile the boat and our lives were. I had no way of knowing the challenges that lay ahead, like having to endure life in the refugee camp or starting a new life in a new country without speaking one word of English. Yet, on that beautiful day on the ship in the South China Sea, as I watched my father look triumphantly in the direction we were going, what I did know was the incredible risk my parents had taken to save us and how love had driven that. And that was all I needed to know. Thank you.
So thank you so much, Master Balno, for being on our Southern Athletes series here on Tales from the South. At the end of your story, you let us know that your family ended up in a refugee camp. Mm-hmm. Do you have any stories about living in the refugee camp or anything that you learned from being there?
Yes, I remember my father waking us up at 5 in the morning with frogs croaking out there. And it's foggy, and my brother and I, my brother Quinn and I, would go out and work out with another kid in the morning. So we did that, and I can cut vegetables like there's no tomorrow because I learned how to knew that from the guy, the chef, the Indonesian chef at the camp. And I learned how to play volleyball there.
So you learned how to play volleyball at the refugee camp?
Yeah, they had like a, you know, like most, I don't know, I know you, if you have ever been to a refugee camp, usually they have nets, you know, it's easy to have a net and on a patch of dirt and everyone's playing volleyball.
You coach volleyball now. Did you play volleyball in college?
Yeah, so I play club. And I used to sneak around. I used a different name just so that my dad wouldn't get mad because I was teaching and competing in martial arts. I didn't want him to discover that I was interested in other things too.
Is it true you were a cheerleader in college?
Yes, that was true. that is true. I was an engineering, electrical engineering major, and we didn't have, I think they had two women in the college, and my girlfriend and I had just broken up, and these two girls in this my jazzercise class said, hey, you want to try out?
Yes,
so I came out, and that was
class.
It.
So the motivation was the girls in your jazzercise class?
No, it's just, you know, different species that you got to experience.
And what did your dad think about you doing cheerleading?
He actually, later on, one of our masters now, her name is Allison, she sent me a letter that my dad sent, you know, to her at the time. Oh, I can't believe my son is now a cheerleader at Florida. But I had a great time.
When you finally arrived in America, was it 3 months after being rescued? How long?
Roughly 5 months.
5 months.
And we got there on University of Florida homecoming day, too. So that was really interesting because my father graduated from there. So we arrived on homecoming day.
Right
in the middle of the parade.
And then you had to start high school in Gainesville, 3 days later?
Yes.
And you didn't know any English?
No.
What was your first day of school like?
So I was having lunch in the lunchroom, and this big red-haired kid, I don't know why, he just choked me from behind, and I'm sitting there. So I had there was nothing I could do, so I bit his forearm. So he let go and then ran off, right? So then I came home, my dad said, okay, the dean's office just called. So you got in a fight on your first day of school? I said, Dad, you know, the kid did this, and what am I supposed to do? And well, it's, you know, out of all the techniques that I've taught you, you bit somebody? And he said, biting is not good in America. But I said, what would you have done? He said, okay. So, but then the next day we showed up and the kid was twice my size. So the kid got paddled and I got let go. That's all I remember.
Well, we have a few minutes here at the end for audience questions.
Have you ever returned to Vietnam?
Yes, what year are we? Yeah, 2003, 2004, my brother and I went back. And it was really interesting because we were not from Saigon, so when we landed in Saigon, we felt like we were foreigners because we're pretty Americanized now, right? So we felt like we were foreigners, but we could understand the language. But the southern thing in Vietnam, apparently we felt like we didn't belong there, so it felt weird. But then we went back to our hometown of Hue. You've seen that movie Full Metal Jacket? That was Hue. So we were on the plane still, we didn't feel anything. You know, we spent all this time and money to go back and we didn't feel anything. But as the plane was above Hue, and people around on the plane was getting excited, all of a sudden we heard our accent. You know, our accent's really cool accent from Hue. Very elegant and beautiful. You know, people swoon when we talk. So they were on the plane, they were talking, all of a sudden, we felt like we're home again. We're these two kids back in our hometown. So my brother and I, you know, we're not criers, but all of a sudden we were just bawling. We were crying on the plane. So that was really special. And then especially visually, you could see the old, you know, the Pophim River, the mountain range, everything just comes rushing back and, you know, in your head, so it was really special. So we were there for about
almost a month, so it was really, really good.
Where was the first refugee camp, and what was sort of your path from there to Florida?
The refugee camp was like a retirement home area that was not occupied in Jakarta, Indonesia. And then, so when we came over, we flew from Jakarta to Hong Kong, to Honolulu, LA, Atlanta, Gainesville. But the reason we went to Gainesville, because my dad went to school there. And so we knew somebody there, so that's why we came back.
Because of your popularity with the youth in the martial arts community, there's a whole bunch of kids in tonight's audience. And I was just wondering, because of your life and death story that you were telling tonight, did anybody counsel you on making sure your story was G-rated?
I think it is, right? No one died. We were fully clothed.
We come in here of support of Unity Martial Arts. My question is, how long have you been practicing Kung Fu?
Let me see. Oh my gosh. I'm dating myself now. I did say in the 1960s I was born, right? 44 years. I was 7, and plus 44 is something. 31?
The refugee camp you were at, you said there was a volleyball court. Isn't a refugee camp kind of like a bad place, like prisoner?
No. Refugee camp is where people need to, they run away to some place. It's a refuge, right? Refugee starts from the word refuge, so that means you find a place that you can be safe. So when people, when you hear refugee camp, it's not a prison. It's more that people are displaced for one reason or another. So they get there so they would be safe.
Oh, so you weren't like escaping from it?
No, yeah. I didn't escape from a refugee camp. I arrived at a refugee camp, and then I made arrangement, you know, to go somewhere else and have a new life.
About how many ships passed you when you were on the boat?
On the first day, we counted, it was 14. And the second day, it was like in the teens, and third day, we just said, forget it, why count? So we didn't count on the third day. But I think the second day was like 16 ships. However, when we were on the ship, to be fair to other ships, except for the Toyota one, now I have a Toyota, believe it or not. But it took me a long time. I went Volkswagen for two generations before I said, oh man, I gotta go with Toyota. I went Beamer too, and then I went Toyota. But anyway, what was the question again? So when we were on the ship, the boat was so small that we were standing there looking at the ocean with the swells, you know, and so forth. Man, and then with the reflection of the sun, it was almost impossible to spot, because we were just up there, we're trying to spot, see if we can see other people's boats. We couldn't see anything. That's how small the boat was. The boat couldn't be but half the distance from this stage to just halfway of this place here. And it's no wider than from here to where I sit. It's really, really small. 20 people on it. And the rusty water didn't taste good.
What was your school like before you escaped?
I came from a really, in Vietnam, you notice a lot of Asian kids, you know, Vietnamese kids, when they came here, they went straight A's, right? Because we took school, in the middle of war too, we took school really seriously. So the school in Hue, the schools I went to, I was in the boys' school, but all the boys had to sit straight up like this, hands either across like this, all the fingernails got to be trimmed, hands like this, and you have a blue pen, a red pen, and a ruler, and you have to write meticulously everything, you know, so you have to know a lot of stuff. And it was very, very challenging. You had to pass a really rigorous test to get in. And then my mom also hired the most beautiful tutor on earth. And I was tutor for 4 years. So if you ask your parents that, where was that? Is that your kid, Eric? Oh, there's the secret.
The refugee camps, did you like it there? Or just... like, what was the experience overall like?
I would think, you know, I think kids from
war-torn countries can probably say the same thing. Kids are really resilient. So you adapt to whatever environment you're in. So we were happy to be alive and when we were there. It didn't, now if I go back and try to do that again, you know, first couple of weeks, I would probably be shocked. But at the time, we had three meals a day, didn't have to study, right? Play, and so it wasn't too bad. For kids, I think you have to appreciate your parents because parents do most of the worrying. The kids just have a good old time. So I think I didn't feel like I was suffering, really. It was rough, thinking back, sleeping on a cot, you know, mosquitoes biting, you put stuff on there, it was hot, it wasn't air conditioned, and it was Indonesia, near the equator, so it was really hot. But, you know, it's hot, you sweat, and you keep going. So it wasn't too bad.
So how about our story and storyteller tonight? Thank you so much, Master Balno, for being on our Southern Athletes series here on Tales from the South. Thank you to our live audience here at the Oyster Bar in Little Rock, Arkansas, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by William F. Lehman Public Library, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, UALR's Department of Rhetoric and Writing, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, Urban Garden Montessori, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
That must be Jenica Jim, don't say like that. That must be Jenica Jim, don't say like that. There she's looking mighty fine, she's dancing a little cowboy hat. Well, she piles her hair up high and she sees me down low. Well, she piles her hair up high and she sees me down low. Got Brent LeBeau on the bass guitar. Yeah, right. Woo!
Rider accommodations provided by Robinwood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Live sound and studio assistance provided by Infrared Studio in North Little Rock. More at infraredstudioproductions.com. You too can experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. We're now traveling throughout Arkansas and the South, bringing Tales to your community. Details on hosting a live show, our schedule, and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive, and we'll see you next week on Tales from the South.